Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and feature stories is designed for people learning English. So we speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. Today, Phil Dierking and I report about an American food craze that comes in early spring. You'll also hear a report from Brian Lynn on the tech industry. And as always, we close the show with an American story. Here is Phil Dierking.
The spring season brings warm weather, flowers, and other changes for people to enjoy. For some restaurant chefs, the most exciting spring arrival is ramps. Every spring, restaurants across the United States compete to be the first to offer the seasonal vegetable. The excitement has even created a ramps black market in Canada. So what is the great appeal of ramps? Maybe you have never even heard of them. Ramps, or Allium trichocum, are a wild plant native to the eastern mountains of North America. They are one of the first plants that grow in the spring, usually between April and May. They are part of the same family as leeks and shallots. They are recognized by their red stem and two long and broad green leaves. They are also famous for their strong taste, similar to garlic and other onions.
Ramps are not as well known as other vegetables, but they have a long history in the United States. In the Appalachian Mountains, ramps have been an important food for a long time. During spring, it is common for small towns in the Appalachian area to hold large ramp dinners for the community. David Townsend owns the Mountain Roots Market and Restaurant in Weston, West Virginia. He uses ramps every year, spending as much as a couple thousand dollars buying the plants. Townsend told us he uses the vegetable in many ways. At his restaurant, for example, he might make ramp burgers. He also likes to mix ramps with potatoes and egg dishes. And he dries them for seasonings. Townsend says you can also enjoy ramps fried, pickled, and even raw. However, others might not enjoy the effect of ramps on your breath. Townsend says the joke was that if you eat raw ramps and you go to school, you would get kicked out of school because you stink. One reason the plant is popular is that it grows in the wild. It is difficult to grow ramp crops on farms. Most restaurants get their supply from foragers. They are people who gather ramps by searching forests for patches, areas where they grow. Townsend said the competitive market for the plant means that when someone finds a patch, they do not tell others where it is.
In the past, ramps were mostly eaten in small towns in the areas where they grew. However, over the last 10 years, ramps' popularity has grown quickly. They are now a highly desired vegetable for many nice restaurants in cities like New York and Washington, D.C. Adam Harvey is the chef at Little Coco's, an Italian restaurant in Washington, D.C. He has been using ramps on his pizzas for about the last 10 years. When spring comes, Harvey says, chefs around the country get excited for the arrival of the plant. They try to prepare it in as many ways as possible and try to include as many choices as possible. It's one of those things where people go a little crazy, Harvey said. He adds that the popularity of ramps in nicer restaurants is a combination of several things. First, it has a really great flavor that is very individual. And second, it's wild. It has such a short season, and you can't get them all the time, Harvey said. Harvey also noted that many chefs want to keep their restaurant offerings seasonal. Ramps are the first green thing to grow after the winter, he said, so cooks feel a pull to use them. Harvey said that his favorite way to cook ramps is to pickle the bulb or bottom of the plant.
Ramps have a short season. Within a few weeks of full growth, the plant is done for the year. This short life cycle is partly responsible for their popularity. And that popularity could lead to their disappearance from Earth. Townsend said, a lot of the public places where ramps are grown have been overdug because of the amount of money that a person can make off them. He added that people who sell ramps to restaurants in New York can sometimes make as much as $20 for half a kilogram. In 2 to 3 months, you can make $2,000 to $3,000, he said. Townsend also said that not everyone who forages for ramps obeys the guidelines for protecting future growth. Foragers are supposed to leave some ramps in the ground to repopulate the area for the next season. But Townsend says some foragers still dig up the entire patch.
In the province of Quebec, Canada, ramps are called wild garlic. In 1995, the provincial government declared the plant a vulnerable species from overharvesting. They also banned selling the plant to businesses. However, the demand for the plant has caused people to illegally harvest the plant in the neighboring province of Ottawa. Canadian police deploy officers in the woods to watch for the illegal activity. The season is short, but it has not ended yet. If you are in the right place, you still have time to try a taste of ramps yourself.
Indianapolis, the capital of the state of Indiana, is not often thought of as a technology center. One city official, however, believes the city's image is changing. Angela Smith Jones is the deputy mayor of economic development. She compares Indianapolis to a version of Silicon Valley. In other words, Indianapolis is becoming a center for new technology-based businesses, similar to Silicon Valley in California. Last year, technology companies in Indianapolis added $7.7 billion to the city's economy. They employed 75,000 people and are seeking more. Openings for technology-related jobs increased 40% last year. Courtney Spence is the founder of a school in Indianapolis that teaches people technology skills. Spence says the city is on the edge of a tech boom. Spence and her school, Kenzie Academy, are trying to keep technology talent in the Indianapolis area. Our point is to bring people from Indianapolis to stay in Indianapolis, says Spence. To do that, the school places students in local companies as quickly as possible. Kavita Kamababu is one of Kenzie's top students. Born in India, she is 36 years old and the mother of two school-age children. Kamababu says that she knew she wanted to work in technology. But she could not launch a career in San Jose or another city in Silicon Valley. She needed to stay close to her home and family in Indianapolis. So she began a 2-year program at Kenzie Academy to earn a degree as a software developer. Recently, Kamababu and some other students were invited to visit a local company called SteadyServe. The business has created an app to reduce waste by measuring how much beer remains in a beer storage container. In the past, the head of SteadyServe, Steve Hirschberger, hired workers from big universities near Silicon Valley. Now he is choosing candidates from Kenzie to work on the coding. He says he likes the qualities he sees in the local workers. It's like Kenzie Academy folded the country and brought San Jose into Indianapolis, he says. However, students who are already in Silicon Valley may not like the idea of working in the area known as the Midwest. Max Camoli is a first-year student at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. Camoli said he would not leave California for Indiana because Silicon Valley already has such a great tech scene already established. Diego Garcia is working on a master's degree at Stanford. He says that when he considers top technology areas, he thinks of California or New York, not Indianapolis. But Stanford University freshman Alexa White has a different opinion. She grew up in Detroit, Michigan, another city in the Midwest. She thinks a technology capital in the region would benefit the field and create diversity. Estimates say women make up only a small percentage of workers in technology fields. In that way, Kenzie Academy in Indianapolis is similar to the rest of the field. Of the current class, only Kamababu and another person, Maya Williams, are female. The next class of 18 students starting later this year will have 3 women. School officials at Kenzie say they are trying hard to bring more women to the school. They are also planning to create more academies internationally, starting in Malaysia. Founder Courtney Spence goes further. She says she wants to create academies like Kenzie all over the world. I'm Brian Lynn.
somebody said, Jane, if you care about animals, you should meet Lewis. So I went to meet him at the Natural History Museum. He asked me many, many questions. I think he was impressed that a young girl straight from England with no degree of any sort could answer so many of his questions about animals. And he gave me the opportunity to go to Olderby Gorge with himself, his wife, and one other young English girl. At that time, Olderby was totally unspoilt. No human fossils had been found. It was just a few animal fossils. All the animals were there, the antelopes, the zebra. One evening, Gillian and I, who were allowed to walk on the plains, we met a young lion, a young male lion, 2 years old, little bits of tufty hair of his mane growing, utterly curious. He'd never seen two people like Gillian and me before, and he followed us at least from here to the far back. And it was scary, but it was also very exciting. And I think that was when Lewis Leakey decided this was the person he'd been looking for to go and try and learn about our closest living relatives in the wild, living in the wild.
That is the voice of chimpanzee expert and wildlife conservationist Jane Goodall. The subject this week of What It Takes, a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. You can find the entire podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Today, we hear The Story of an Eyewitness by Jack London. On April 18, 1906, San Francisco, California, suffered a huge earthquake. Jack London went to the city to report on the disaster. Learning English announcer Doug Johnson narrates that report.
Not in history has a modern city been so completely destroyed. San Francisco is gone. Nothing remains of it but memories and a few homes that were near the edge of the city. Its industrial area is gone. Its business area is gone. Its social and living areas are gone. The factories, great stores and newspaper buildings, the hotels, and the huge homes of the very rich are all gone. Within minutes of the earthquake, the fires began. Within an hour, a huge tower of smoke caused by the fires could be seen 100 miles away. And for 3 days and nights, this huge fire moved in the sky, reddening the sun, darkening the day, and filling the land with smoke. There was no opposing the flames. There was no organization, no communication. The earthquake had smashed all the modern inventions of a 20th century city. The streets were broken and filled with pieces of fallen walls. The telephone and telegraph systems were broken, and the great water pipes had burst. All inventions and safety plans of man had been destroyed by 30 seconds of movement by the earth. By Wednesday afternoon, only 12 hours after the earthquake, half the heart of the city was gone. I watched the huge fire. It was very calm. There was no wind. Yet from every side, wind was pouring in upon the city. East, west, north, and south, strong winds were blowing upon the dying city. The heated air made a huge wind that pulled air into the fire, rising into the atmosphere. Day and night, the calm continued, and yet, near the flames, the wind was often as strong as a storm. ¶¶
There was no water to fight the fire. Firefighters decided to use explosives to destroy buildings in its path. They hoped this would create a block to slow or stop the fire. Building after building was destroyed. And still, the great fires continued. Jack London told how people tried to save some of their possessions from the fire.
Wednesday night, the whole city crashed and roared into ruin, yet the city was quiet. There were no crowds. There was no shouting and yelling. There was no disorder. I passed Wednesday night in the path of the fire. In all those terrible hours, I saw not one woman who cried, not one man who was excited, not one person who caused trouble. Throughout the night, tens of thousands of homeless ones fled the fire. Some were wrapped in blankets. Others carried bedding and dear household treasures. Many of the poor left their homes with everything they could carry. Many of their loads were extremely heavy. Throughout the night, they dropped items they could no longer hold. They left on the street clothing and treasures they had carried for miles. Many carried large boxes called trunks. They held on to these the longest. It was a hard night, and the hills of San Francisco are steep. And up these hills, mile after mile, were the trunks dragged. Many a strong man broke his heart that night. Before the march of the fire were soldiers. Their job was to keep the people moving away from the fire. The extremely tired people would arise and struggle up the steep hills, pausing from weakness every 5 or 10 feet. Often, after reaching the top of a heartbreaking hill, they would find the fire was moving at them from a different direction. After working hour after hour through the night to save part of their lives, thousands were forced to leave their trunks and flee. At night, I walked down through the very heart of the city. I walked through mile after mile of beautiful buildings. Here was no fire. All was in perfect order. The police patrolled the streets, and yet it was all doomed, all of it. There was no water. The explosives were almost used up, and two huge fires were coming toward this part of the city from different directions. 4 hours later, I walked through this same part of the city. Everything still stood as before, and yet there was a change. A rain of ashes was falling. The police had been withdrawn. There were no firemen, no fire engines, and no men using explosives. I stood at the corner of Kearney and Market Streets in the very heart of San Francisco. Nothing could be done. Nothing could be saved. The surrender was complete. It was impossible to guess where the fire would move next. In the early evening, I passed through Union Square. It was packed with refugees. Thousands of them had gone to bed on the grass. Government tents had been set up, food was being cooked, and the refugees were lining up for free meals. Late that night, I passed Union Square again. Three sides of the square were in flames. The square with mountains of trunks was deserted. The troops, refugees, and all had retreated. The next morning, I sat in front of a home on San Francisco's famous Nob Hill. With me sat Japanese, Italians, Chinese, and Negroes. All about were the huge homes of the very rich. To the east and south of us were advancing two huge walls of fire. I went inside one house and talked to the owner. He smiled and said the earthquake had destroyed everything he owned. All he had left was his beautiful house. He looked at me and said, "The fire will be here in 15 minutes." Outside the house, the troops were falling back and forcing the refugees ahead of them. From every side came the roaring of flames, the crashing of walls, and the sound of explosives. Day was trying to dawn through the heavy smoke. A sickly light was creeping over the face of things. When the sun broke through the smoke, it was blood red and small. The smoke changed color from red to rose to purple. I walked past the broken dome of the City Hall building. This part of the city was already a waste of smoking ruins. Here and there through the smoke came a few men and women. It was like the meeting of a few survivors the day after the world ended.
The huge fires continued to burn on. Nothing could stop them. Mr. London walked from place to place in the city, watching the huge fires destroy the city. Nothing could be done to halt the firestorm. In the end, the fire went out by itself because there was nothing left to burn. Jack London finishes his story.
All day Thursday and all Thursday night, all day Friday and Friday night, the flames raged on. Friday night saw the huge fires finally conquered, but not before the fires had swept 3/4 of a mile of docks and storehouses on the waterfront. San Francisco at the present time is like the center of a volcano. Around this volcano are tens of thousands of refugees. All the surrounding cities and towns are jammed with the homeless ones. The refugees were carried free by the railroads to any place they wish to go. It is said that more than 100,000 people have left the peninsula on which San Francisco stood. The government has control of the situation, and thanks to the immediate relief given by the whole United States, there is no lack of food. The bankers and businessmen have already begun making the necessary plans to rebuild this once beautiful city of San Francisco.
And that's our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.